York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling or grave thy victory? If you meet the Undertaker or the young man from the crew, have a pint with what's left over. Now I say goodbye to you. For the bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory?
Good morning, John.
Good morning, Malachi.
And Sean,
Malachi, who fears to speak of Easter week?
Is it Easter week? You know, I was wondering about this, John. They say that the God guy sent his son out to die for us. And I was wondering, there are 7 billion of us alive now, and they figure that one guy is enough to die for all of us. Is that right? Is
that I'll take that.
But why do we have to have 2 deaths? Isn't one enough? I mean, if they figure he is equal to all of us, why not let him do it and let us live forever?
Well, I don't know about living forever. I think at some stage we're going to get fed up with this place.
Really? I'm enjoying it no end.
Well, Malachi, on today's show, we'll have a running theme of not so much religious, but the political significance, particularly from an Irish point of view, where we're going to play Micheál MacLattimore reading the Proclamation of 1916.
It's Alfred Whitehead. I think he's real. He was not Irish at all. He was an Englishman, Alfred something or other. But he pretended to be Irish, and that he invented a whole lineage for himself, that he was from Cork and everything else. But he was actually a Cockney, born in London, and he lied all his life. He was a magnificent liar.
And, well, I tell you one thing, he does a great job on an album reading the 1916 Proclamation, which was just read on O'Connell Street about an hour ago on behalf of the government there. So throughout the world, wherever Irish Republicans are, there used to be Easter commemorations, which we'll talk about later, how it was commemorated in Limerick and here in New York. But we'll be playing that, and then a lot of the music is going to be pertaining to the Irish uprising in 1916. Now, remember, this is not Independence Day for the Irish. They don't have an Independence Day because this led to a treaty, blocking off of the 6 counties in the north, dividing the country, and a civil war. And then another uprising of 30 years in the 60s and 70s until where we're at today with a split country, 2 different ways of tackling the virus over in Ireland, which is unbelievable that they can't get an island-wide how to deal with this threat.
Well, there's such a love of walls, right, and borders and divisions. Here we have this tiny little country that's 32,000 square miles. It has 32 counties, and approximately 1,000 for each county. And we have been separated since 1922. And this tiny little place that is, it's twice the size of Rhode Island. That's all it is. 1/10 the size of Texas. Can you imagine that? And here we are. Still occupied since 1691. King Henry II, he got permission from the Pope to invade Ireland, that the Irish were falling away from the faith. So His Holiness, Aloysius, was it? I forget which Pope it was, told Henry II. And his mother And various other people said, don't do it. They're all crazy over there. But he came anyway and invaded again. But St. Patrick came first. He was an Englishman. And he bollocksed up a perfectly good pagan country in 432. And he said, oh, why don't you all convert to this other fella in a couple of thousand miles away. So they did. They all converted. But then they drifted away, and then the Pope said, go and get them. So there they were. They came, they saw, they conquered. How about that for an original statement?
Well, Malachi, just let me let our audience know what we have online for today. We're going to have on a friend of yours, Jim Brooks, at the 12 o'clock hour.
Yeah.
From Minneapolis, is it?
Yep. Yeah, St. Paul.
And then he's going to be – he runs a newspaper out there called the Irish Gazette, and we'll be talking about that. And then around the 12:30 mark, something that we've been doing here on Radio Free Erin is running clips called The Show Must Go Online from the Irish Repertory Theater with Mick Malampy. But Malachi, and I don't want to get too much into it now, there's a New York Times story about a fundraiser that was supposed to happen for the actors tomorrow. That's not happening, and it has to do with unions, but the three of us could talk about that in a little while. And I just wanted to send a shout out to Councilman Danny Drum, who was on the BBC World Service there during the week, talking about what was going on in Queens, and he was mentioning about the friends he lost, and he brought up about how his good friend Turlock McNellis, and I just thought Turlock would get a good kick that his name was mentioned on the BBC World Service by Danny Drum.
In what sense was he mentioned, John?
Oh, well, it was Danny Drum talking about the friends he lost in Jackson Heights and around Queens.
Yeah, yeah.
And he brought up about Turlock being one of his friends that was lost. And they were talking about Elmhurst Hospital and everything going on in his district.
Yeah.
I mean, he's in the forefront of it there.
Yeah. Well, he actually died, didn't he? I mean, that's what happened to him, of this disease.
Yeah, of the virus, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So, just in case people might misunderstand the expression lost.
Well, yes, you've written a book on that, Malachi.
I have, indeed.
Should I remind you?
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
And yes, people can get it on Amazon. Death need not be fatal.
Yeah, death need not be fatal. And and we have, what, over 8,000 now have died in the state of New York?
Yeah, and counting. I mean, the numbers going up. And they said that doesn't even include the people who are afraid to go to the hospitals and are dying in their homes. They're saying of heart attacks and other diseases that they're so afraid of catching the virus at the hospitals that they're just dying in the house.
And did the groper-in-chief, alias Trump, did he say that there are people dying now that never died before, or am I mistaken?
No, all right. Now you bring up, there's a clip I want to play about our great president, Dr. Donald J. Trump, Donald John Trump.
Yes.
And I want to tell you, Malachi, I know you find it hard to believe, he is probably one of our greatest presidents. He's done the best ever on this virus. And do you know how I know that?
How do you know that, John McDonough?
Because he told me 116 times in the last couple of press conferences. That's how I know it. So, Sean, if you can go, I want to give Malachi a little lesson about why President Trump is so great.
Okay. I'm agog to hear it.
I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before.
I think that we've done a fantastic job. We've done a phenomenal job on this.
We should be saying congratulations instead of asking a really snarky question.
Call it luck or call it talent, it doesn't matter. We made a great decision.
Some of these governors, you know, they take, and then they complain. They take, and you do a great job. You build them a hospital. You do other than that, they're always complaining.
Hard not to be happy with the job we're doing. That I can tell you. I'll tell you what, the federal government's done a hell of a job.
There's nobody could have done a job like that.
Most people have never seen anything like it.
I think we're doing very well, but, you know, it's a two-way street. They have to treat us well also. They can't say, oh, gee, we should get this, we should get that. We're doing a great job.
There's going to be nobody better than Donald Trump. They're loving what we're doing. Honestly, people should respect, because nobody's ever seen anything like what we've done.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your response to this crisis?
I'd rate it a 10. I think we've done a great job.
See, Maliki, nobody's ever done anything better. He is the best. He, on a 1 to 10, he should have said 11. I don't know why he stopped at 10. So, you know, you got to, you know, praise him when he needs to be praised, Maliki.
No, John, look, he's a very modest man.
Isn't
and he knows that self-praise is no praise. And he just laid out a couple of facts and told us what a fantastic guy he is. But he doesn't do it in any boastful way at all. He just very quietly lays out a couple of facts, and he asks people not to dwell on it, because he's delighted to do it for America. And so, and then, you know, John, there's various other countries, you know, they're boasting, like the United Kingdom, the virus alert. The English are feeling the pinch now in relation to the recent virus threat, and have therefore raised their threat level from miffed to peeved. And soon, though, the level may be raised yet again to irritated or even a bit cross. The English have not been a bit cross since the Blitz in 1940, when the tea supplies nearly ran out. This virus has been recategorized from tiresome to a bloody nuisance. The last time the British issued a bloody nuisance warning level was in 1588, when threatened by the Spanish Armada. Now, the Scots have raised their threat level from PO'd to let's get the bastards. They don't have any other levels. This is the reason they have been used on the front line of the British Army for the last 300 years. The French government announced yesterday it has raised its alert level from run to hide. The only two higher levels in France are collaborate and surrender. The rise was precipitated by a recent fire that destroyed France's white flag factory, effectively paralyzing the country's military capability. Italy has increased the alert level from shout loudly and excitedly to elaborate military posturing. Two more levels remain: ineffective combat operations and change sides. The Germans have increased their alert state from disdainful arrogance to dress in uniform and sing marching songs. They also have two higher levels: invade a neighbor and lose. Belgians, on the other hand, are all on holiday as usual. The only threat they are worried about is NATO pulling out of Brussels. Now, the Spanish are all excited to see their new submarines ready to deploy. These beautifully designed subs have glass bottoms, so the new Spanish Navy can get a really good look at the old Spanish Navy. Australia, meanwhile, has raised its alert level from no worries, she'll be all right, mate. Two more escalation levels remain. Crikey, I think we'll need to cancel this barbecue this weekend. And the Barbie is cancelled. So far, no situation has ever warranted use of the final escalation level. The Russians have said, it is not us. So that's the way it is, John, on the international level. We didn't do it.
Did you get that from your friend, our guest last week?
I got that from Hector Elizondo, the wonderful actor that he spent a half an hour with us, and he bunged this off to me to let me know what was happening. These are mostly European, but they're around. They're around.
Maliki, another thing that's coming out about this virus is how the media are turning to Britain. I've had to turn off the TV twice now. The Queen gave some sort of message at one stage, and then she gave the Easter message, I guess, today. And I'm watching MSNBC or CNN, and they're carrying her speech. And then we got the two crime families in New York, the Cuomo crime family, the Blasio crime family, fighting amongst each other over the school closing. But now we got Cuomo pontificating about how great Winston Churchill was during World War II, forgetting all his history about the Boer War, what he did to Ireland, and just the devastation he caused in India. So, I mean, we get this bizarre thing where we have to turn to Britain to see what they're doing. I mean, I have to hand it to Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He talked about the herd mentality, that we all have to get it and weaken the virus. My God, did he go out and get that done?
Okay. Well, the Brits have always been very kind. They came to Ireland and civilized us. And I think that was so good and Christian of them. And they took a perfectly good pagan country and they turned it Catholic. And then they changed their minds, and they said, you can't be Catholic. You have to be Church of Henry VIII. So I think, John, we should follow their example. They're such good people.
Well, you know what, Malachy, I'm going to play now. There was a couple of people in Dublin in 1916 who read out a proclamation in front of the GPO on O'Connell Street, who really didn't agree with the invasion and the occupation of Ireland. And we're going to play this, and I love it that America, and New York particularly, was so involved with the uprising that they included it in the proclamation. So we're going to go to Micheál reading the proclamation of 1916, which at any Irish Republican gathering is read throughout the world.
This is the proclamation issued to the people of Ireland by the leaders of the Rising of 1916. It was roughly printed, and it was posted onto many walls in the city of Dublin on the morning of Easter Monday. Poblach na hÉireann, the Provisional Government of the Irish Republic, to the people of Ireland, Irish men and Irish women, in the name of God and of the dead generations from which she receives her old tradition of nationhood, Ireland, through us, summons her children to her flag and strikes for her freedom. Having organized and trained her manhood through her secret revolutionary organization, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and through her open military organizations, the Irish Volunteers and the Irish Citizen Army, having patiently perfected her discipline, having resolutely waited for the right moment to reveal itself, she now seizes that moment and, supported by her exiled children in America and by gallant allies in Europe, but relying in the first on her own strength, she strikes in full confidence of victory. We declare the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and to the unfettered control of Irish destinies to be sovereign and indefeasible. The long usurpation of that right by a foreign people and government has not extinguished the right, nor can it ever be extinguished except by the destruction of the Irish people. In every generation, the Irish people have asserted their right to national freedom and sovereignty. 6 times during the past 300 years, they have asserted it in arms, standing on that fundamental right and again asserting it in arms in the face of the world, we hereby proclaim the Irish Republic as a sovereign, independent state, and we pledge our lives and the lives of our comrades in arms to the cause of its freedom, of its welfare, and of its exaltation among the nations. The Irish Republic is entitled to and hereby claims the allegiance of every Irish man and Irish woman. The Republic guarantees religious and civil liberty, equal rights and equal opportunities to all its citizens, and declares its resolve to pursue the happiness and prosperity of the whole nation and of all its parts, cherishing all the children of the nation equally and oblivious of the differences carefully fostered by an alien government which have divided a minority from the majority in the past. Until our arms have brought the opportune moment for the establishment of a permanent national government, representative of the whole people of Ireland and elected by the suffrages of all her men and women, the provisional government hereby constituted will administer the civil and military affairs of the Republic in trust for the people. We place the cause of the Irish Republic under the protection of the Most High God, whose blessing we invoke upon our arms, and we pray that no one who serves that cause will dishonor it by cowardice, inhumanity, or rapine. In this supreme hour, the Irish nation must, by its valor and discipline, and by the readiness of its children to sacrifice themselves for the common good, prove itself worthy of the august destiny to which it is called. Signed on behalf of the Provisional Government, Thomas J. Clarke, Sean McDiarmid, Thomas McDonough, P. H. Pierce, Eamon Kent, James Connolly, Joseph Plunkett.
Well, Maliki's, those words back in 1916 on Easter Sunday on the steps of the GPO set in motion an unbelievable revolution, counter-revolution, civil war, the dividing of the country, and really led directly to the, you could say, the 30-year uprising in the six counties. And Maliki, I've always wanted to ask you, how was it celebrated in Limerick as you were growing up, just politically? In Limerick, the 1916 uprising, how were you schooled in it, and what did you learn about it?
Well, there wasn't much, really. Some members of the old IRA did march, but generally speaking, it was very quiet. It was more religious than it was political. They didn't want anything to upset because of the differences between the pro-treaty and the anti-treaty. And then our own government was executing people who were opposing them on about signing a treaty with Britain. So it was very, very quiet, and the whole thing was to do with religion. And it was here we have people in the north of Ireland who are spitting on people who are marching and celebrating what the Easter Sunday and the Rising. And Easter Sunday, 1916, it was the 24th of April, 1916, that this Rising took place. And there was 1,300 people in the General Post Office, the GPO, which they took over. And all of those people who signed that Declaration of Independence, you'll note that it says Irish men and Irish women, it says, not just, and Britain has no written constitution, unlike the United States and like Ireland. The only thing about Ireland was that they did make special reference to the Catholic Church, and that I think that's been knocked out. Some provision of the Constitution has been knocked out. But there were thousands and thousands and thousands of Irish men and women were fighting for the British Army in that First World War, which was merely a domestic row between the royal families of Europe. The Queen and the Kaiser, they were cousins. The Tsar was another cousin. All these people were related, and these people were dying for them. And so, and the slaughter, what was there, 50 or so million people got killed in that bloody thing. The Irish the Irish people won more of their Victoria Crosses than anybody else outside of the Brit. Here they are dying for this, and only about 2.5% of the people supported the Rising in 1916, and they and the brutality of the what they did to the those people. All of them were executed. All the leaders of that revolution were executed. James Connolly was badly wounded, and so he couldn't stand up. And so they sat him down in a chair and shot him. And they shot the other brother, the brothers Pierce. Their mother came to see them the night before they died. She saw her kids get killed by the Brits. And here we had people saying, oh, Britain was fighting for the rights of small nations, and here they are shooting people who were fighting for their right to be free. And so that's been going on, and they're there. They've been there now for 1161, I think they arrived first, and they've been there ever since. And that tiny 6 counties in the northeast of Ireland. There are 32 counties, 6. There's no natural border there. There's no natural barrier. There is nothing that separates that country from the rest of the country except the word of people like Winston Churchill, who absolutely despises the Irish, as did his father. His father died, by the way, of syphilis, as did Henry VIII. The French called the syphilis the English disease. So that will tell you about England. A lot of syphilis there.
Well, Maliki, on this side in New York, there's been a long tradition of commemorating the 1916s. I mean, I started going to commemorations up at Gaelic Park in the late 70s and 80s and into the 90s. And in the beginning, there was actual people there at these commemorations that fought on both sides in the anti-treaty. And there was a bitterness there that the ones that were pro-treaty came to Gaelic Park with their medals on, and they accepted the pension from the Free State government, where the likes of Michael Flannery and Joe Steins refused medals, they refused pensions, because they said they did not fight to have the country divided. So after the commemoration at Gaelic Park, a lot of us would walk over to Keenan's on Broadway, about a block or two away, where people from the Clan of Gael and Irish Northern Aid, and then would have a proper commemoration condemning the Free State government along with the British. And they were very bitter people, Maliki, that came over. And I know you were talking about Limerick, about the anti-treaty. The anti-treaty Republicans couldn't get any jobs in the government or the guards or the army. So they were forced to leave, and they came over very bitter. And one of them was Mike Quill, who founded the transport workers, a great IRA man and Republican. So we had a different view on this side of the Atlantic about the 1916. It was definitely an unfinished revolution that was going on. And you knew by the splits in Ireland how it affected New York, because there could be maybe 4 or 5 different commemorations at different parts, whereas socialist, communist, splits in 1969 with the officials and the provisionals. So, I mean, but it was always commemorated, no matter what.
And that spilled over too, John, into the, oddly enough, into the Spanish Civil War as well. There was the Blue Shirts, who were pro-treaty, and they went and fought for Franco. And then the others, the real IRA, were on the other side. And they died there too. I mean, the bloody thing spilled over all over the world. There are 65 million people of Irish descent around the world. And they hear, and these bloodlines are are all over the place, and they're still going on about the treaty. The bitterness and the rage and the anger that we there's nothing more savage than civil war. So we saw that here when 600,000 people here were killed in our own civil war. And I don't know what the civil war in Ireland lasted about 9 months, I think, but thousands were killed and thousands were executed. And it just, and that bitterness, I remember I was in a little shop. My mother had sent me out to get something. And a man said to the woman behind the counter, "I'm sorry to hear about your brother." She said, "Well, I'm not. What do you want?" So he said, whatever. So anyway, I went to my mother and I said, "Why was she not sorry about her brother dying?" Oh, she said, "They were on the opposite side in the Civil War." Even then, and that was 1940. And so I was already, that was maybe 20, 25 years previous to that, that this bitter outburst. And I was only a kid, but I was about 8 or 9, but I was shocked to hear her saying she was not sorry about her brother dying. So that's the kind of a thing that is representative of the feeling that there was at that time.
Well, Malachy, nothing concentrates the mind like being in the gallows and being ready for death or revolutions, because during peacetime, you really do not get that great of songs or poetry. But during that time frame, you had William Butler Yeats wrote the poem 1916, and then yes. Brendan Behan wrote Who Fears to Speak of Easter Week. So right now we're going to play a clip of the poem by William Butler Yeats as read by Liam Neeson. And right after that, we'll hear Brendan Behan, the one and only, Who Fears to Speak of Easter Week. And then we'll talk about that when we come out of this.
Yeah, certainly not.
I have met them at the close of day, coming with vivid faces from counter or desk among gray 18th century houses. I have passed with a nod of the head or polite, meaningless words, or have lingered a while and said polite, meaningless words, and thought before I had done of a mocking tale or a jibe to please a companion around the fire at the club, being certain that they and I but lived where motley is worn. All changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. That woman's days were spent in ignorant goodwill, her nights in argument until her voice grew shrill. What voice more sweet than hers when, young and beautiful, she wrote to harriers? This man had kept a school and rode our winged horse. This other, his helper and friend, was coming into his force. He might have won fame in the end, so sensitive his nature seemed, so daring and sweet his thought. This other man, I had dreamed a drunken, vainglorious lout. He had done most bitter wrong to some who were near my heart, yet I number him in the song. He too has resigned his part in the casual comedy. He too has been changed in his turn, transformed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. Hearts with one purpose alone through summer and winter seem enchanted to a stone to trouble the living stream. The horse that comes from the road, the rider, the birds that range from cloud to tumbling cloud, minute by minute they change. A shadow of cloud on the stream changes minute by minute. A horse hoof slides on the brim, and a horse plashes within it. the long-legged moorhens dive, and hens to moorcock's call. Minute by minute they live, the stones in the midst of all. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Oh, when may it suffice? That is heaven's part, our part to murmur name upon name, as a mother names her child when sleep at last has come on limbs that had run wild. What is it but nightfall? No, not night, but death. Was it needless death, after all? For England may keep faith for all that is done and said. We know their dream, enough to know they dreamed and are dead. And what if excess of love bewildered them till they died? I write it out in a verse. MacDonagh and MacBride and Connolly and Pierce. Now and in time to be, wherever green is worn, are changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born.
Who fears to speak of East our week, that week of famed renown? When the boys in green, they went out to fight the forces of the crown. With Mauser's bold and hearts of gold, the Red Countess dressed in green, and high above the GPO, the rebel flag was seen. Then came 10,000 khaki coats, our rebel boys to kill. Before they reached O'Connell Street, of fight they got their fill. They machine guns and artillery and cannon in galore. But it wasn't our fault that Erewhon got back to England's shore. For 6 long days we held them off at odds of 10-1. And through our lines they could not pass for all of their heavy guns. And deadly poison gas they used to try and crush in vain, and burdened our Irish capital like the Germans did Louvain. The Anglo-Saxons make great contributions to culture, don't they? They shot our leaders in a jail without a trial, they say. They murdered women and children who in their cellars lay. They dug the grave with gun and spade to hide them from our view, because they could neither kill nor catch the rebels so bold and true. But we will love old Ireland and shall while life remain, and we will say Godspeed the day the rebels will rise again. The Irish slaves and English knaves may try you to deceive. Remember those who died for you, and likewise James Connolly's grave.
Okay, that was someone you met when he was over here in New York, the one and only Brendan Behan.
He was the problem with Brendan, the problem he had was that he was severely diabetic, and so people thought that he drank a lot, but he didn't drink a lot. He couldn't drink a lot. He was allergic essentially to alcohol. And so a couple of Guinness and he was gone. And but people were constantly after him. Oh, come on, Brendan, have a drink. I remember the night of the opening of the play The Hostage on Broadway, and there was a big party at Jim Downey's restaurant and bar on 8th Avenue, a great, very famous and popular place for their show business people. And Jim Downey was very kind to actors who were broke and all of that. So he didn't press them for overdue bills and so on. But the night of the opening of the Hostage, Jackie Gleason was there, and Brendan's wife, Beatrice, was over as well. So it was a very pleasant party. And after the show, at those days, the reviews used to come out the same night. The reviewers were like Brooks Atkinson, and people at the Times would run off out of the show, write the review, and then at the opening night party, they would get the reviews, and you either got a great review or a bad review. And if it was a bad review, of course, people disappeared. They didn't want to be congratulating anybody on a bad one. So anyway, Jackie Gleason was trying to get Brendan to drink. His wife was here. She came over for it, and she was telling him not to drink. And Gleason was really, he was quite obnoxious that night. But anyway, so finally the staff threw Jackie Gleason out of Jim Downey's. So I'm looking out the front window there, and there he is outside on the sidewalk, and he's shaking his fists and jumping up and down in an absolute rage, and he's banging on the door wanting to come in. They finally had to get the police to remove him. But that was that night, and he did not come in. But then subsequently I met him. He was doing a movie out in Paramount, and I was doing the Molly Maguires, I think, at the time. So I was sitting outside, and Jackie Gleason came along in a golf cart, and he stopped, and he wanted to talk to me about being on the Mike Douglas show. So that was my couple of encounters with Jackie.
And Maliki, a couple of weeks ago, we had on your friend Dermot McAvoy, who has a book out now, and I can't recommend it highly enough. It's called Real Irish New York.
Right.
And there's a chapter on Brendan Behan, and I would recommend reading Behan when he was living at the Chelsea Hotel on 23rd Street, New York. And there's a great plaque to him. Paraphrase here, the man who hates New York hates humanity. And Brendan just loved New York, and he wrote a book about Brendan Behan's New York, and that would be another book that people should read.
Well, he said one thing about New York, Brendan said, was you're in no danger of being attacked by wild sheep in New York. I don't know what that meant, but there it is. So you can come to New York and not be afraid of wild sheep. There it be. But Brendan, when he was dying, and there was in the Dublin hospital, he was a very severe diabetic. That was his problem. He was alcoholic, but he was badly afflicted by the diabetes. And when he was dying anyway, there was a nun mopping his forehead. He was very warm and hot and so on. And he opened his eyes and he said, "Thank you, sister, and may all your sons be bishops," said he to the nun.
And he died. He was 41 years old, and he had a Republican funeral. I remember reading one of his books that he went to the Republican movement and said that, when I die, I want a Republican funeral. And that was nice that he got a great send-off in Dublin.
Yeah, there was a very sad time. That was a very sad time. I mean, two very prominent literary figures died very close. Dylan Thomas, who hung out in the White Horse, and Brendan hung out everywhere. But Dylan Thomas, I think, was only 39. And then Brendan was 41. And they were practically just kids, actually, when they died. But it was, he was quite a good poet and a very imaginative writer. But good Lord, it was, he just couldn't stay away. I never did have an alcoholic drink with him because I didn't want to be. I had enough sense, even though I have a bit of a problem. I haven't had a drink in years, but at that time I did. But I did not drink with him, and I decided I didn't want to contribute to his insanity. It was too because I felt so sorry to see him going down and people just roaring at him, come on, have a drink. It was very, it was awful.
And Malachy, he had some great quotes. One of them was, there is no situation that the guards couldn't make worse.
Yes, the police, yeah.
Yes, the guard of Shekinah.
Yeah. Harley's situation so bad that the police can't make it worse.
That could probably be used a lot worldwide. But Malachy, you want to take a few calls before we head out to Minnesota?
Why don't we do that?
Yeah, well, the number here at BAI, you can tell us about how you're self-exiling yourself. This used to be called in, you could say, in South Africa or Russia, you're under house arrest, which is what's going on right now. The number here at WBAI is 212-209-2870. And I got to make that a zero because if Monroe was still alive, he would chastise me.
Yes.
The number here is 212-209-2870. Oh, 77. Okay, got that corrected.
Yes.
This is what when you type in WBAI phone numbers, that's what came up. But okay, so it's 212-209-2877. How is everybody doing under house arrest? How do you feel about the two crime families in Albany and New York fighting over the school system here in the New York City area? About I'm going to close them. No, you're not. I'm going to close them. I'll tell you when to close them. And no, I don't pay attention to politicians. I pay attention to the people that matter. I mean, oh, for the love of Jesus, can we end this feud just till the end of the virus, please? Is that asking too much of Cuomo and de Blasio? Oh, my God. Mal, you talk about the Irish having grudges. This grudge match that's going on in Albany and New York, it's epic proportions.
But this is these are two Italian folk, aren't they? Why are they fighting?
Oh, what, you don't think they're fighting? Haven't you seen any movies?
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, I think with the both Cuomo and de Blasio, they have the O at the wrong end.
Well, you could probably say that.
But
you want to call in before 12 o'clock, because we'll be heading out to Minnesota, it's 212-209-2877.
209, John.
Huh?
209, John.
Oh, yeah, 209-287. What am I?
Otherwise,
dyslexic?
You're going to get corrected.
I've been giving out the number for 40 years. What's going on here? 212-209-2877. How are you doing under house arrest? Or are you breaking the law and going out into the parks? Okay, we'll take the three calls before 12. BAR, you're on the air with the one and only Malachy McCourt.
And John McDonald. Malachy.
How are you, John? How are you, Malachy? It's Anthony. I'm sitting on my porch with my cat reading your book, My 40 Years. And my wife is Janine, your big follower. My 40 years of working in the construction business and dealing with the Irish and the Italians have brought me great insight into your book and making me feel so wonderful with the little lines in there. And I can understand the counties and listening to, and I have a great friend who lives in Dublin that I communicate with. And he shares the stories with me that are reflected in your book. And just it's an understanding of how people can be different, but yet so similar.
And which book are you reading?
Death Be Not Fatal.
Oh, okay. Malachy has 10 of them, so we got to find out.
Well, okay. That's the one that my wife bought at the WBAI studios.
Oh, right. I remember. Yeah. Very good. Yeah. Thank you very much.
She's always in the front row, Malachy, and she's a great BAI supporter along with Anthony.
But two of them. Danny Boy, too.
You got Danny Boy, too. How about singing that, Janine? So can you sing it?
He can sing that, but I could show you that I bought an 8-track, which I still have in works. It was a TV special 8-track from 1973. And I bought that 8-track and all different various artists, but for two songs on it. One was Danny Boy, and the other one was Amazing Grace, performed by the Royal Scots Dragoons. And those songs always were with me, and I still have that 8-track tape, and it plays on an 8-track player that I have in my basement in my workshop.
I'm singing.
Yeah, go. Put her on.
Okay. Well...
Is that the bagpipes?
No, not the bagpipes, but she's going to sing.
No. Yes.
Hold on a second. Let's sing it.
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling. From gleam to gleam and down the mountainside.
The summer's gone and all the flowers are dying. Tis you, must go, and I must buy. But come ye back when summer's in the meadow, or when the valley's hushed and white with snow. Take it.
Tis in shadow. Oh, Danny boy.
I love you so. Very good.
You know what, Malachi? The next time we have with David Rothenberg downstairs, hopefully at the Brooklyn Cafe, we have to get her up to sing.
Oh, I love
absolutely,
that.
Yes, we will. Okay.
I missed your last one. I missed it.
Well, you'll be there for the next one once we come out of this. But listen, we're going to go to the next two phone calls, but it's going to be very hard to top you two over there in Brooklyn.
Love you guys.
Bye-bye. Thank you, love. Right. Thanks, Anthony.
There you go, Malachi. You never know what we're going to get. B.A.R., you're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. I'm calling from Vancouver Island, Victoria, British Columbia.
Good heavens.
Good God, welcome. New Zealand and now this.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I just want to hear, you know, because I have family that live in Dublin. And they're under, lockdown.
Well, how are things up in Canada where you are?
Well, if things are not very good, I mean, I can look over the apartment, see over the Pacific Ocean and English Bay. Everyone's on lockdown. It's like a ghost town, Victoria.
And listen, how did you end up there? And where are you from in Ireland?
I was born in Vancouver. Uh-huh. My relatives are from Dublin I don't remember quite where else. But anyway, things are like a ghost town up here.
And then how did you know to listen to WBAI or listen to this show?
Well, I've been listening for the last, about 6 months.
Hmm. Hopefully you're enjoying it.
Oh, very much so, because there's a repertory theater in Vancouver Irish repertory theater in Vancouver.
Yeah, well, we have the premier one here in New York City on 22nd Street, the Irish Rep, run by Kieran O'Reilly and Charlotte Moore.
Uh-huh.
Well, listen, we'll take one more phone call, Malachi, before we head out to the Midwest. Not as far as Vancouver, but B.A.R., you're on the air.
Hi. It's Judith from the Upper West Side. I have three things to say. The first thing is, I want to thank all of you for doing this program always, and then I want to say I wish that we could just drag Trump in the streets the way they did with Mussolini. And the other thing is, would you please recite A Terrible Beauty Was Born of Yeats in honor of this day?
I think we just did that, didn't we, Malachi? Wasn't it the 1916 poem?
Oh, you did that? Oh, I'm sorry. I was listening to Bach's Easter Oratorio at that time.
You yeah,
stand
we
at
did
the
that.
Window at 7 o'clock and make noises of thanks to the healthcare workers.
Yes, okay. Well, Malachi, what we're going to do now is play a song that I just love. It's called The Lonely Banner Strand by the Wolf Tones. And it's about landing German rifles. And that's another curious thing, how the Irish hooked up with the Germans during World War One. You know, England's enemy is our opportunity. And that Sir Roger Caseman, who would have been like royalty to the British, was executed in London Tower. But what do you think about the song The Lonely Banner Strand and the rifles being brought in from Germany?
At the First World War, yeah.
Yeah.
It was, I think the enemy of my friend is my friend. Yeah, that's
yes.
it, isn't it?
Yes.
I always get that wrong.
That's how the Irish, I mean, there's stories about, I think even Sir Roger Caseman or whoever went over to Germany going into the POW camps and trying to convert the Irish that were in there to come over to the German side.
Yeah. Well, it was, yeah, because, I mean, it was just a civil war between the royal families. Well, look at them all killing each other just because they're having a row. My God, the murder, 60 million people, I think, were killed for that. Bloody stupid thing.
But Malachi, there was a big contradiction while we were bringing in rifles at the Lonely Banner Strand. James Connolly was hanging up his infamous banner at the transit workers or the Labour Party, stating that we will serve neither King nor Kaiser.
Yes, that's right. So. And also, he, of course, was a great friend of Lenin. And he was a pure Marxist, and he believed in equality. He believed in looking after old people. He looked after people who were poor people, sick people, and that was his whole thing. He was a man of great sense of justice.
Well, socialist. That's who Mike Quill got his inspiration with the transit workers here in New York City to set that up based on James Connolly and his work in Dublin before. Yeah. And we will be playing that song later on in the show with a poem before it by the Wolf Tones. Right now, we're going to go to the Lonely Banner Strand and then head out to speak to Jim Burks with the Irish Gazette and see how the Irish are doing out in Minnesota.
All right.
Lonely Banner Strand. my native land, and I mean to free my countrymen on the lonely Bannastrand. They took Sir Roger
Yes, I mistakenly thought it was going to be the Wolftones, and I sent it in. But that's Damian Dempsey, who was on WBAI when he was a mere 18-year-old and working at Rocky Sullivan's on Lexington Avenue. And he's considered really the Bob Dylan of Ireland right now. And he's just an unbelievable folk singer and writer. And you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM. On the dial, as Malachi likes to say, or not like to say. And if you do like Radio Free Erin and you want to contribute, because I know one of the Cuba boys contributed last week, you can become a WBAI buddy by calling 516-620-3602. You can make any contribution towards the show, towards WBAI, or become a BAI buddy, which means $10 a month will come out of your credit card and it'll go directly to the station that they can make a budget. And the number is 516-620-3602, and help out the station in these trying times. But Malachi, I'm going to throw it over to you with your friend out in Minnesota.
All right. Thank you very much, John McDonough. Malachi McCourt here. John said this is WBAI, and you can become a buddy if you call up the number. Anyway, a friend of mine is from Minnesota, is in Minnesota. My beloved Diana was born there, and so I've always had, for some reason, I am very grateful, and I have become a friend of this grand band, Jim Brook, for a number of years. Are you with us, Jim?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Oh, I made
great.
It through the snowstorm.
Oh, you have a snowstorm?
Well, it just kind of missed the Twin Cities here. But
oh, I see.
it's a little south, and it's supposed to be 5 to 9 inches. And yesterday, it was 60-some degrees. So if you don't like the weather now, just wait a few minutes. It'll change.
So, Jim Brook,
how are you?
You are the publisher of the Irish Gazette in Minneapolis. Is it St. Paul or Minneapolis?
Well, St. Paul.
St. Paul, okay.
Yeah.
So, is that a separate municipality?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
It is.
There's a very competitive edge there between these two cities. Minneapolis is the bigger city But St. Paul is the capital.
Oh, it is. I see. What St. Paul is? What is the mud? What is the mud appellation there? What is it called? Is it called Mud City or something like that?
St. Mud. St. Mud, are you referring to?
Was that
St. Mud? Yeah, that was a book that was by Thayer. Very, very good book. St. Paul is the older city. I grew up in North Dakota, Fargo, but my grandparents on my mother's side, my grandfather on my mother's side, was originally moved to St. Paul with his sisters and brother from Richmond, Indiana. But that's another story. I digress.
How about your Irish connection there, Jim?
Well, my mother was all Irish. They were from West Waterford and, well, North Wexford. And my father, Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, yeah. English bastardization of the Irish word, but his father was from Armagh.
Yeah.
Protestant from Armagh. And his mother, his mother was born and raised in Norway. So I've got three quarters Irish. And my kids are more Irish than I am because I married the Irish lass. And, so that's the Irish background.
Well, you have a huge, it seems to me anyway, you have a huge gathering there, gatherings over the year.
Yes.
Front page of the Gazette is just one huge, looks like thousands of people marching.
Well, we have the what we like to say is the greatest St. Patrick's Day parade in St. Paul. However, we had to cancel it this year, but we'll take it up either later in the year or we'll do it up better next year. But it's a great parade. There was a sheriff years ago in Ramsey County, which is St. Paul, and Minneapolis is Hennepin County. Anyway, the Ramsey County Sheriff was Headman, and he used to say, "Oh yes, there were." This would be back in the 50s, late 60s and early 70s. He said, "Yeah, there's 250,000 people at the parade." Well, some of the people that were around at the time said, "Well, I don't think so." Headman was a good booster of St. Paul. And then we have, and Malachy, we've been trying to get you out for this, we have the Irish Fair of Minnesota right on the river. Mississippi River. And that's the other thing you read about. That's in August. And we don't know for sure if that's going to come out or not, along with, Milwaukee is the largest Irish Fest in the world, and they're a year younger than we are in St. Paul in Minnesota, but we don't know, because of this this virus that we all have.
If you don't know, you can't predict, of course, if it's going to be held this year. Is that in August?
Yeah, we can't predict. I just got off the phone this morning with Tom Whalen, who is the executive director of the Irish Fair of Minnesota. And the plan is to go ahead. And just like the plan was to have the St. Patrick's Day parade up until Thursday before the Tuesday parade, and then it was canceled. So... But, we're all at the, we want to have the best for the people. So if we have to cancel things, then we can hold off. We're patient.
Yeah.
We put up with the British for years, so we're patient.
What's happening politically there? It was always, you always had the Hubert Humphrey and that wing of the Democratic Party. Is that still extant?
Oh, yes, yes. Now we have two women U.S. senators.
Yeah.
Amy Klobuchar.
Yeah.
His father was a friend of mine. He was a journalist for the Star Tribune, and he got his start in the newspaper business in Bismarck, North Dakota. And that's a whole story. Amy and I talk about that. Anyway, then he came down to the Star Tribune. He was very prolific. I'd pick up a Star Tribune and he had four articles. He made the editors happy. They could count on him for filling the pages. And the other senator is Tina Smith, who was appointed under Dayton. And Dayton was the governor before. When we've got a great governor now, Tim Walz, who is doing a great job with the virus situation. He's doing a great job, kind of like Cuomo is doing in New York.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the Queens accent, but he's got the Mankato, Minnesota accent.
Yeah.
I think he grew up down in Southwest. And you know, Maliki, you remember Gene Foley, of course. That's how
Oh, my God, yes, yes.
Yeah. Gene Foley
told me. He was a small business SBA boss, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah,
and then, I remember.
And then he was an advance man for Lyndon Johnson.
Oh, right, he was indeed.
You remember that?
Yeah,
yeah. And he was a great guy. I'm sorry to say he passed away in 2015.
Yeah,
he was a wonderful guy. He was born in 1928, and so he had a good long run.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I'm 31, so I want to hang on there behind a lot of people like him. I want to stick around a while. There we are. Is Amy going to be vice president?
Well, she's got all the qualifications. She's a very smart person, and she has the know-how on how to deal with everything. So we're hoping on it. I haven't talked to her. Her husband John got the virus, and he got it in D.C. and she was on the campaign trail at the time, and then he finally went in and they put him in the hospital, but. After they put him on a ventilator, he came across. Now, I haven't talked to John for a while since this happened, but I see the news reports, and Amy says he's doing well. So, you know, that knocks a lot out of you. And so she could very well handle the job. And Biden might pick her because he's tossing it around, you know. It's who's up when now the convention was going to be held in Milwaukee, and we'd planned on going down to the convention, and you know and now they moved it up at the same weekend, the first Monday after the Irish Fest in Milwaukee. Well, Milwaukee Irish Fest draws people in from all over North America. And so I don't know if that's going to – I don't know where they're going to get the hotel rooms for those two things. But, you know, the Irish Fest will be letting out on Monday morning. And convention starts on Monday afternoon, if that's the case. We don't know, but...
Oh, my God, that would be a sort of a bit of a conflict, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Of some sort, yeah.
It wasn't planned for that, but no. they had it in, I think, of the second or third week in July.
Yeah.
And they moved that out of there. And,
yeah.
But Milwaukee is, what was that TV show that two girls, a wife of...
In a factory, was it?
Yeah.
Something. Yeah, that one.
They had a great run. He
that's right. Yeah. She was a director also. I forget her name. Oh my God, this is terrible. I have my colleague here, Jim, is John McDonough, and
yes, John.
So say hello to him.
Well, yes. Malachy, it's funny when I hear Jim, he was talking about Bismarck, North Dakota. The only thing I know about Bismarck, North Dakota is from The Honeymooners, when Ralph Crampton was being named a Raccoon of the Year, and he's reminding Alice, he says, you know what we get? We get free burial privileges in the National Cemetery in Bismarck, North Dakota.
that's
my history book. For anything about Bismarck, North Dakota. We're going to be buried there, Alice. But you're talking about picking Klobuchar for vice president, and that's not really what's happening. As far as I can see, with Biden doing his hostage videos from some undisclosed locations, and he's acting like Vinny the Chin Gigante in his bathrobe, what he is picking is the next president. Because God knows if he's going to last his 4 years. So if he does pick her, he's not looking at her as a vice president. He's looking at her as the next president. Because if he does do the 4 years, hopefully it'll be her for the following 8 years.
Well mark my words,
bad.
John. Mark my words. Amy could handle the presidency very well.
Well, Trump has made it a very low bar, which, you know, you could only imagine if Obama was holding the same bizarre press conferences that he is, because he's now reminding me of a carnival barker in Coney Island. Step right up, see the bearded lady inside, 5 cents. I mean, the man is bizarre, and, you know, he's got to go.
Yeah.
Well, I think he has the... tertiary stage of syphilis. That's my opinion, because I think he's gone totally cuckoo. All this babble that he goes on with all these, what he calls press conferences, but they're just dopey tirades, and it makes America look very foolish in the eyes of the world. But
but he's been doing it for 3.5 years, so.
Yeah, he has, and the poor people that follow him don't seem to know. The less they understand him, the more they like him, because they say, "Don't let us understand you, and we'll be just fine." So keep babbling. That's what he does. What is the situation politically now in, say, in Minnesota? Are you would he be elected? Would he get the Minnesota vote?
Well, I don't think so. But
yeah,
you know, I sit on the fence, far away, overlooking it, and hope to hell he won't win the Minnesota vote. And he didn't before. He did in Wisconsin, but he didn't in 2016. But Minnesota has had very good reaction. Well, I mean, it's never very good, but they have a better numbers than Wisconsin. And he won in Wisconsin.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm not drawing any conclusions, but I'm just saying. You know, like the guy says, I'm just saying. And but
I want now you're the paper, the Irish Gazette, which it's a very
a very intelligent paper. You have language courses. You have you can teach people. People can learn the Irish language. And very extremely well written pieces of both national and international import, and that is fantastic. To be able to get that in a paper these days, how is it? What's the circulation?
All of them. From all of. I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. I'll lighten up. I'll be serious for just a split second.
You don't have to be.
We have over 12,000 circulation.
Yeah.
But we've been very fortunate, Maliki, as you know. We have Sean Farrell, who is a retired consul general from Chicago, who happened to be a good friend of mine. And he always wanted me to take him to North Dakota while he was in Chicago, but things kept because he North Dakota things, and I think Sean is probably listening, and so I can see him smiling now back in Dublin, he is right on top of things, and his column is very good, and then now. With the coronavirus, we're picking up, and we hadn't been using it for a while, the website, but we've got Jane Hall is working on our website and putting fresh stuff up, and it's theirishgazette.com, and so we carry Sean's in that, and we have another fellow who was an architect retired out of Galway, and Dick Byrne, and Dick is a very good writer across the bay is his column, and that just kind of little newsy stuff about what, but he's got a good insight. And then Will Kenny is the man you referred to for the Gaelic classes, and Will has done a marvelous job in getting Gaelic. In the community.
That's fantastic.
Stone ear for languages. I knew Spanish when I was growing up, so I was able to navigate when I go to Mexico, but I just have a tough time. I have, and you met this man too, Maliki, when you were here, Sean Kelly. Sean Kelly was a retired. Remember, he was a writer from Pioneer Press. Yes.
Yes, and, I do indeed. Yeah.
And Sean would, we'd be sitting in Dunn Brothers Coffee, which is a nice Irish haunt. And we'd be sitting in Dunn Brothers, and he'd try and get me to teach me something about Gaelic. And he'd end up just, and finally, we'd have. I would just leave. I'd say, Sean, if you're going to still yell at me, I'm leaving. And so I'd go out the door, and people would say, oh, you and Sean are carrying on again?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then now we have, I just want to get this in too. Cormac O'Shea and his wife Natalie had started Celtic Junction, which is a big building that they put in St. Paul. And that building houses the Center for Irish Music and the own McKiernan Library.
And, yes. Oh, my God,
And O'Shea's School of Dance. Now, Cormac was the second in command behind Michael Flatley in Riverdance, the original Riverdance. When Michael would go on a tear or something, Cormac would fill in, but Cormac was a long, lean dancer that he's a wonderful, wonderful person, or a great dancer, and he fell in love with Natalie when they came through the cities here with Riverdance. And the other person that we have connected with Riverdance is Katie McMahon, who is the lovely, lilting voice of river dance. And she fell in love with Ben Craig, and they married. And so we have them both centered out of the Twin Cities.
Oh,
and
my God.
Really great, you know.
Yeah, I saw Riverdance. Bill Whelan is an old friend of mine, and he's also a Limerick man, and his father was a good friend of mine as well. And so Bill is he's back, of course, in Roundstone, but he's been going. Millions of people have seen that, and it's an astonishing. I came out of 7 minutes of a fill-in at a singing contest, and all of a sudden became this. It's all of a sudden it made Irish dancing very fashionable altogether. And would you now the other big fair you have there is it's when is it again?
It's Milwaukee Irish Fest.
Yeah. So that is, but isn't there one in Minneapolis at some point?
No. The only one is Minnesota Irish Fair. Minneapolis has the parade, and it's Sean and his wife Judy run the Minneapolis St. Patrick's Day Parade.
That's what it is. Yeah.
And
what
we
about
have,
the what was the other thing? There was something else I wanted to ask you about. Anyway, it'll come to me in a minute again.
Yeah, Malachi, we're going to have to start wrapping up soon and get to the next segment.
Well, this is great, Jim.
Yes,
James Elliott Brooks of the publisher of the Irish Gazette in St. Paul, Minnesota, and thank you very much. And love to all you love there, Seamus, my old flower. Grand to have you on. And we'll keep in touch. Let us know when you get, when there is a vice president from your grand place there.
We'll talk then. I got to tell you, Malachi, my wife picked up your latest book, Death, book, and we had to go on a little trip yesterday, and she was telling me her interpretation of it. Death need not be fatal. And
yes,
she loves your writing, and she of course has written and read others, but she hadn't read this. We recently moved, and so I had. I've got more books than a man needs, but I love them. So, and so we moved to a smaller, much smaller house. We were in a 4-plus bedroom house. And we moved to a 2-bedroom house, and there just isn't enough wall space for the bookshelves.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
But
I've
got them in the basement and up at the cabin. Anyway, so
I can't stand throwing out books. They are so precious, and yet, as Diana says, come on, Malachi, some of them are just fat magazines, and get rid of them. So anyway,
well, there was my wife has given me the roundup thing, but I got one more thing. When we had the north bedroom, and I had a lot of shelves in that bedroom, and when we decided we were selling the house, I started counting the books, and I stopped counting just in that one room alone because I had them double spaced in the back and all the thing, and I was at 10,000. And I hadn't even gotten to the other rooms in the basement and everything, so I just thought,
oh my God,
that's enough. I'll stop counting.
What you should do is have an auction.
Pardon me?
Yeah. Have an auction. Auction the books.
I buy them all back.
Oh, that's what you wouldn't be able to bear to part with them, Seamus.
Well,
all right, me old son.
I go downstairs to do the laundry, and then I look over and I look at some of the boxes, and I pull out the thing. Next thing I know, it's an hour later.
And, you're sitting down and you're reading away. Yes. At first fright. Away we go. Okay, my old son. We will talk again soon. Thanks a lot, Seamus.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Nice talking to you, too, John.
All right. Thank you.
And yes. Love to the missus. And off we go. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Well, Malachi, we're probably going to play one of the most famous songs from 1916 is James Connolly. And we come out of that. I'm going to speak to Mick Malampy, who's now been doing, going on a month now, clips from The Show Must Go On Live from the Irish Repertory Theatre. And one of the first clips we'll be talking about when we come out of the song will be Gabriel Byrne is addition to this. So right now, The Wolf Tones with James Connolly.
We continue our tribute to the great men and leaders of 1916. We'd like to remember the working class hero of Ireland. We'd like to remember a man called James Connolly. The man was all shot through that came today into the Barrack Square. And the soldier I am not proud to say, we killed him there. They brought him from the prison hospital. And to see him in that chair, I swear his smile would far more quickly call a man to prayer. Maybe I don't understand this thing that makes these rebels die. Yet all men love freedom and the spring clear in the sky. I wouldn't do this deed again for all that I hold by as I gaze down my rifle at his breast. But then a soldier I. They say he was different, kindly too apart from all the rest, a lover of the poor. His wounds ill-dressed, he faces like a man who knew a greater pain than blows or bullets ere the world began. Died he in vain? Ready, present! And him just smiling. Christ, I felt my rifle shake. His wounds all open, and around his chair a pool of blood. I swear his lips said, fire. Before my rifle shot that cursed lead. And I was picked to kill a man like that. James Connolly.
A great crowd had gathered outside of Kilmaida, their heads all uncovered, they knelt to the ground. For inside that grim prison lay a brave Irish soldier, his life for his country about to lay down. He went to his death like a true son of Ireland. The firing party he bravely did face. Then the order rang out, present arms and fire. James Connolly fell into a ready-made grave. Though the right flag was hoisted, the cruel deed was over. Gone was the man who loved Ireland so well. There was many a sad heart in Dublin that morning when they murdered James Connolly, the Irish rebel. God's curse on you, England, you cruel-hearted monster. Your deeds, they would shame all the devils in hell. There are no flowers blooming, but the shamrock is growing on the grave of James Connolly, the Irish rebel. The four courts at Dublin, the English bombarded, the spirit of freedom they tried hard to quell. But above all the dead rose the cry, no surrender, towards the voice of James Connolly, the Irish rebel.
Yes, the Wolf Tones singing James Connolly. I tell you one thing, you'd be a long time living in Ireland listening to RTE before you would hear that song and poem. We're going to go to the next segment, which now we're into a month. We wished it wasn't going into a month, but the Irish Rep is doing a segment called The Show Must Go Online. But now they're branching out because of this and the length of time of the virus and the close down of the Irish Repertory Theater. We have Mick Malampy. And Mick, what is the Irish Rep up to that now they're doing helping the Show Must Go Online, but now they're doing something else.
Hiya, John. Hiya, Malachy. How are you?
Hello there.
Good to hear from you guys again. Yeah, like many theatres all over the world and lots of creative actors and people, they're taking the show online. We started with this little project on St. Patrick's Day, showcasing the best and most loved Irish poets and writers and playwrights and musicians with the company members of the Irish Rep. And we stuck it up on the social media and on the Irish Rep YouTube channel. And we called it hashtag Irish Rep Online and hashtag The Show Must Go Online. And from there now, they have a new series that they've been working on and put together. And it's called hashtag IRT for Irish Rep Theatre, Meet the Makers. So this new segment that they're doing, they're releasing, it's like a short little interview style video every week, every Thursday. They're going to be releasing it on their website, irishrep.org, and it's Meet the Makers. It's a series of interviews and chats with some of the people behind Irish Rep Productions and what makes the Irish Rep tick, the directors, actors, stage managers, and everyone who keeps this wonderful New York City institution ticking along. These videos, they're released every Thursday directly on their website. I watched the very first episode that came out on Thursday, and the wonderful director, young director, Conor Bagley, who has directed at the Irish Rep, he has a chat with Kieran O'Reilly and Charlotte Moore, who a lot of the listeners will know and a lot of people know from the Irish Rep. They're the people who started it all 30 years ago. And he chats with them about their lives in the theatre, as well as all their wonderful work with the Irish Repertory Theatre down on 22nd Street in Chelsea. In this first episode, you can actually, Charlotte tells the story of how she actually hung up on Harold Prince as a young actor living and working in Hartford, Connecticut. He was calling her up to ask her to come to Broadway, and she just thought it was somebody playing a prank on her. And so she hung up on him. Obviously, Hal was persistent and eventually got his woman. And it's just a very interesting insight for people to see what goes into mounting the productions that they mount, and also just some really lovely background to the theatre and the people who work there.
Well, who's the first clip now this week? And I know Malachy. Have you met with Gabriel Byrne?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, I've known Gabriel for a number of years. Yeah. I saw him at Riverdance last month. Yeah, he was there that opening night. We went on the 11th of March. Yeah, he was there.
Right,
he's a good lad, and saw him something else too that I saw him at Hunter College. He was doing something there too. With Colin McCann. That was it. Yeah, that was when Colin launched his book there. So that was another Gabriel Byrne night. He's everywhere.
So what's the first clip, Mick?
The first clip here, we have Gabriel Byrne. As lots of people, everyone knows, he's one of our most treasured talents from the big screen and Broadway. He took some time out to share his voice and wonderful talent to The Show Must Go Online, an Irish Rep Online, with a piece from James Joyce's She Weeps for Rahun.
She Weeps Over Rahun by James Joyce. Rain on Rahun falls softly, softly falling where my dark lover lies. Sad is his voice that calls me, sadly calling at grey moonrise. Love, hear thou how soft, how sad his voice is ever calling, ever unanswered in the dark rain falling, then as now. Dark too our hearts, O love, shall lie, and cold as his sad heart has lain, under the moon-grey nettles, the black mould, and the muttering rain.
Well, Mick, I know these clips are 45 seconds each, and who is it you have up next?
Next we have Caitlin Gilogley. Caitlin has a wonderful piece from The Parting Glass. Rep audiences, remember Caitlin from the lovely production On a Clear Day You Can See Forever.
Oh, all the comrades that I've had are sorry for my going away, and all the sweethearts that I've had would wish me one more day to stay. But since it falls unto my lot that I should rise and you should not, I'll gently rise and I'll softly call. Good night and joy be to you all. Good night and joy be to you all.
Yeah, well, Mick, what I want to do is go through the next three, introduce each one separately, and then I wanted to talk to you and Malachi about this story in the New York Times about what's going on Broadway. So who's the next piece?
So the next piece is Matt Gibson, who also starred in On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever. He has a lovely rendition of The Streets of Dublin from Stephen Flaherty and Lynn Ahern's musical Man of No Importance. Right after that, we have Billy Finn, who's doing a brilliant performance of The Wild Rover, which many listeners will know of. And then ending this week's presentation of these wonderful actors and performers is Katie Sullivan, who actually was one of the first people to submit. She's given us a bit of The Kerry Dance by J.L. Malloy, and Rep audience members would remember Katie from the wonderful production of Love, Noel that was at the Irish Rep last year.
So, take Sean, if you could there. Just go through all three, and then we'll come back and have a discussion on the Times.
Sing along. And there's music like nothing you've heard if you know the right jukebox to play. There are glasses to raise in the praise of surviving the day. Down where Miss Kitty Farrelly's pouring whiskey and Frankie Donahue is lighting her cigar. A smoky den where working men don't bring the wife. It's the laughter of fellows with stories to tell. Men who love to get drunk and raise truth back in hell. Oh, you'll come out with me and you'll see what you're missing in life. On the streets of Dublin.
Hey everyone, I'm going to play a little Wild Rover for you. If you know the song, sing along.
Well, I've been the Wild Rover for many's the year, and I spent all me money on whiskey and beer. But now I'm returning with golden grade store.
and the merry piper's tuning, meet us along with such wild delight. Oh, to think of it, oh, to dream of it, fills my heart with tears. Oh, the days of the canny dances, oh, the ring of a piper's tune, oh, for one of those hours of gladness, gone, alas,
and welcome back to WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. And we're just playing clips from the show Must Go Online. If you want to see the videos, and the videos are great, go to theirishrep.org and you get to see all the actors and directors and Kieran and Charlotte and everyone. But I wanted to finish this last 10 minutes that still has to do with the theaters. An article that's out today in the New York Times, and the headline is, labor dispute sinks Broadway benefit for pandemic assistance. Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS had planned to stream a concert of Disney songs, but canceled the program when a union demanded compensation from musicians. Now, I'm coming at it, Democratic family, Queens. My father was in Con Edison Union. I've been in three or four different unions. But this is so bizarre that one union has banjexed the streaming of this to raise funds for other unions. And I know, Mick, I sent you the article, and you wrote a thoughtful response to it. I wanted to get your response to what's going on to this, that a fundraiser that would have helped actors, and then Malachi and you are both members of these unions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Malachi, you go ahead there.
I believe in that people should be compensated for work they do, because many times that people are taken advantage of in the hope of being seen or being noticed or cast in something. But this is bizarre, John, as you said, that to help out all the folks who are out of work at the moment, and they are, I mean, Broadway is completely dead. I see absolutely no reason why we cannot, as actors, make some sort of a, if we can possibly, we're not forking out any money. We're merely just given a bit of time, a bit of our whatever talents we might have. And there's nothing, to me, that is a laudable thing to do. And to say, well, we're not going to give them money. We're working. We're not working for nothing. We're working for our fellow human beings, for our fellow artists. And it would be a very decent and good thing to help people, because those folks have, we all have financial responsibilities. But just to take a few minutes and give a few minutes of our time, nothing wrong with that. It's not union busting. It is not strike breaking or anything like that. So I find that reprehensible that a union would screw up a good cause like this. So that's my thought on it.
Yes, Mick.
I mean, I absolutely agree that I think it's a great shame that a charity event is going to be banjaxed because of one union. And let's make it clear here, it's not Equity, it's not the Actors Union who are saying anything about this, it's Musicians Union. Now, just on the other side of it, I do have to say, I've been calling my union all week because my show got postponed recently, therefore my health insurance, for instance, is up at the end of the month, and my coverage is finished with that. I've been speaking to people at Equity this week, at the Equity Health League, and the one problem a lot of these unions and these organizations have is because Broadway is shut down, there is no money coming in. So there's no money coming into the unions to be able, never mind to pay their, you know, people their wages. There's no money coming in to prop up these programs that a lot of people are relying on in this pandemic right now. I mean, I'm the very first person to say, like, the creativity of people and people donating their time and their craft for charitable, you know, events right now is absolutely wonderful. But I do, I can see the side from the musician's point of view, from the musician's union. I'm not talking about musicians, I'm talking about from their union head here. Like Malachy mentioned a minute ago, you know, in the arts, a lot of actors and musicians, you know, we've been paid for years in what's the word I'm looking for, in exposure, you know, and a lot of musicians, they don't get paid for a lot of their work. And to be fair, I know that this is the Broadway Cares charity that's putting on this event, but Disney right now, who it's a showcase of Disney from Broadway for the last 25 years. Disney is one of the wealthiest corporations in the world. Disney are going to get plenty of good grace and benefit from a show like this. And the musicians were paid for recording the show, as were all the performers back in November when it was actually recorded. And the issue now is when it comes to streaming. So the union wants his members to be compensated for their work to be streamed for this event. Disney right now is making money hand over fist with all of the streaming that they're doing into every single person's home across America right now. So maybe if the pressure was put on Disney to maybe make sure that people who participated in this event in November were adequately compensated for their talent, in which is going to be a streaming event now, then that could be one way around this situation. You know, again, we're not talking about megastars here who are, you know, packing out arenas regularly or selling loads and loads of records. We're talking about people who are working as artists for a living, and we're all suffering right now. And I think sometimes it's the full story. I felt from that article yesterday that we weren't getting the full picture of what is actually kind of going on right now. There is a lot of goodwill out there. A lot of people want to donate their time and their energy. But, you know, there's also the fact that a lot of people are don't normally get paid. And I do think that this particular union is, you know, doing their best, A, to keep their union solvent, and B, just, you know, using this as a teaching moment that, you know, we do rely on our artists.
But the teaching moment that they're trying to make us all learn from is going to be taking money away from actors, who the two major union, Actors Equity and SAG-AFTRA, they've agreed to it, and Disney's agreed to waive its fee for airing it. And it just seems a little bit bitter that the smaller union out of all three are the ones that are going to block a fundraiser for the actors, because the music's great. But unless you have the actors in the musical, I mean, and everyone has been paid already because it was filmed in November. And what they're doing is just airing it and trying to raise funds on that for Broadway Cares. I don't know. Sometimes the unions, man, could be their own worst enemies.
I completely agree with you. I agree with you with that, Joe. I agree all those points. I can see both sides here. And it might seem kind of petty, but again, this is to raise money for the Actors Fund. And again, the musician union is a separate entity here. So I can just kind of say that maybe it is a little bit petty, maybe it is kind of sour grapes. But I'm trying to think about I have more of a succinct point, but it's just kind of running away from me now right at the moment.
And Malachy, I just go to Malachy. Do you get health coverage still from AFTRA and SAG and
Oh yeah,
Acquis,
I get it
Equity?
Anyway, because I qualified over the years for my years in. I am officially retired. I mean, I get benefits anyway, no matter what happens. And I am delighted that is the case. But the thing, perhaps, if we made an agreement that if all the big producers, like the broadcasting companies, the production companies and so forth, all equaled what the actors give, I think that might be a good thing to do. Say $1 for each actor, for whatever the actors, or whatever actors donate in the way of time and effort. And then let them equal that.
Malachy, we're going to have to wrap up. It's almost 12:55. I wanted to finish up with Sinead O'Connor singing The Foggy Dew, but I just thought it was important that we address this issue.
Because
we're doing a whole thing
you.
About the Irish rep and off-Broadway, Broadway theaters that even during this pandemic, we still can't get together. I mean, to me, it's unfathomable. But listen, if de Blasio and Cuomo, the two crime families, can't get together, I guess Broadway is not far behind.
In fairness, I think Broadway, I think most people do want to get back to work, and people do want to donate, and they want to, you know, give their time and their talents. But, you know, there's a sticking point here, and I would like to have seen more of what the head of the musicians' union had to say on this when it came to that article. That's just the way I'll leave it there. But
all right, so maybe more on that next week. You're listening to Radio Free Erin every Sunday, 11 to 1. We had calls from New Zealand, Vancouver Island, and, you know, people are listening out there. Malachi, thanks. Mick, thanks.
Thank you, John. Thank you,
and if you want Malachi, he's on Facebook, Malachi McCourt. If you want to get in touch with myself, John McDonough, offthemeter.net. One word, offthemeter.net.
You're listening to WBAI New York. I'm Celeste Katz-Marston. New York is the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic sweeping the planet. The battle against the virus has profoundly changed Americans' way of life. For some, it means death. WBAI is collecting the stories of New Yorkers fighting their way through the storm.
My name is Juan Galloway. I am president and CEO of New York City Relief, which is a mobile outreach to people struggling with homelessness. I've been working with people experiencing homelessness for 17 years, and in all those years, I've never seen anything like the level of desperation, hunger, lack of resources, and nowhere to run for those who are most vulnerable to the COVID-19 virus. The COVID-19 pandemic has really served as a blacklight to expose an issue that was already an utter disaster, which is the largest homeless population in the nation in New York City. We are a mobile outreach that goes to seven different locations around the New York City metro area every week. And we serve soup, bread, hot chocolate. We give out socks. And that draws in hundreds of people to get something to eat. But then we help them with the long-term help, like shelter, rehabilitation, job training, medical care. But primarily during this pandemic, we have been having to focus on essential services, meaning food, because many of the soup kitchens around New York City have shut down because they're volunteer run, or they're run by retirees or people that were not able to cope with the, the health and safety protocols. Typically, we might serve around 400 meals in a day. But what we've seen is double the amount, up to 850 servings, meals in one day. We've seen lines around the block, down the corner. It's amazing. I've never seen anything like it in all my years. To protect the people that we're serving, we had to make sure that, first of all, our volunteers and our staff had safety equipment, masks, gloves, disinfecting surfaces. So we space people out in line by 6 feet between each person when they're waiting for food. We provide hand washing or sanitizing stations for those who are on the streets. We also provide flyers and literature to help them understand how to prevent the virus, because they're not able to watch the news at home. They have no home. We also have been giving out paperwork with lists of resources, like the other places they can get food in the city, places they can get showers. There's not that many. Places they can get medical care. Many are elderly and many have compromised immune systems. And so we're trying to connect them to those vital resources to keep them alive. When the pandemic hit, most of our volunteers actually canceled on us, which is understandable, taking health precautions. But what I was really touched by was the many volunteers who stepped up. Not as many as we usually have, but even today, I had an elderly woman who is I've known her for many years. She's been a volunteer for many years with us, and she's very poor herself and just a step away from homelessness, but she shows up every week. There she was, handing out socks to people and giving them, you know, a kind word, an encouraging word. And so I love it when I see New Yorkers show up and put themselves